Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast.
Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. We're back. We're going to talk a little bit more about Sgt. Pepper, following on from our first part last week, which we realised was quite a gallop through what was a very busy 4.5 months of recording. So there's still an awful lot more to talk about, and we're going to cover it from a couple of different angles. But we want to talk about the album and its release and its afterlife. When we left it last week, we were at the end of recording, so the end of March, the start of April 1967, when they're doing With a Little Help from My Friends and the second version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. But probably the most pivotal thing that happened outside of the recording itself happened right at the end of March, on the 30th of March, when the Beatles had the cover shoot for the album itself. And as far as album covers go, it's a pretty unique and special thing, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's, at the time, if you think Revolver was the album that went before, which is a very stark black and white line drawing, and here it's sort of completely over the top, colourful cast of thousands.
Yeah, and I remember finding out as a kid that, you know, it's a real thing. And it's really shocking to find out that the Sgt. Pepper cover was a real thing that the four Beatles climbed into to get their picture taken. That it's not a photo collage. It's not a... Obviously, there was no digital trickery, but there certainly was photo collage trickery at the time. And the fact that this is a real room that was put together for the photo shoot still kind of boggles my mind.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I mean, I think it never occurred to me that that was the case. I think as a kid getting the album, I just assumed this was the sort of thing, collage that you do yourself, cutting pictures out of magazines and people's faces. And it is very odd.
It is very odd. So there's a lot of things to take in about the album cover, but it's to their credit that they went as far as they did, because it started with a couple of little seed ideas. And I think the original seed of the idea was that Paul McCartney was thinking of some kind of municipal situation, like a brass band type thing.
Yeah.
And this notion that there were floral arrangements and floral clocks in the local councils of England, and people would get their pictures taken there in these kind of official ceremonies. Isn't that the seed idea?
Yes, I think that was the notion. And as with all these covers, there's a little sketch, you know, that Paul, a little line drawing at some point. But there is this idea that whenever they were in Sweden on tour, one of their sort of first tours after they sort of hit it big, he was given an album and by a Swedish group, and it has a cover that's very similar.
There is, there's people in these kind of regimental, colourful costumes.
Yeah.
I forget the name of that album.
We can put a picture of that up. But yes, it was this idea that it was a municipal band or a marching band, and the idea of the flowers at the front, I think, was one of the, was Peter Blake's wife, Jan Hayworth.
Yes.
Is that how you pronounce that?
I think so.
Came up with this idea of having seen a floral clock. She thought this would be... This would be very good. So it's a cover that, you know, you can pore over it. You can try and identify everybody that's there. You can see the cryptic messages. You can see the supposedly the pot plants.
Yeah,
pot plants in the front. So it's befitting the contents, I think.
So Paul has this idea, and I think he takes it to his art friend Robert Fraser, and he's the person who brings in Peter Blake and his wife Hayworth and the photographer Michael Cooper, whose studio is used. It's apparently a very small studio, but Robert Fraser is the person who gets it from Paul's notion of a mayor or a town council or something into something that's very much pop art. And it's, you know, probably the most famous person out of that trio is Peter Blake, who's gone on to have a long and illustrious and ongoing career as a pop artist. So he was still very much at the early part of his career, but it was a very wise choice, you know, that he's somebody who went on to really make a difference in British art.
Well, he's just designed the cover of the new Who album.
Yes, yep. He also designed the old. He designed Face Dances, But so. Yeah, he's done the new Who album. Yeah. And there's certainly a, you know, you look at the new Who cover, there's a very noticeable Peter Blake style that perhaps you don't get out of Sgt. Pepper. But you see it in Paul Weller's Stanley Road. That's another one of his covers. And he did a Madness cover a few years ago as well. But yeah, Robert Fraser really had his finger on the pulse of what was happening to pull in those exact right people. Yeah. And also for them to be given, for them, i.e. the Beatles, to be given the money to do this, because this was an expensive cover.
This was £3,000 in old money, which I'm reliably informed is about £50,000 today.
Which seems relatively cheap today. Yeah. I'm sure there's marketing budgets for $50,000 is a drop in the ocean, considering how much videos cost in the '80s.
Except today, of course, you would just Photoshop everything in, and yes, it would look
like a different thing altogether. But yeah, and it comes together quite quickly. As we said, the photo shoot was on the 30th of March. They spent about 8 days assembling the cardboard cutouts and the faces and the models and the actual environment for it. But when you think about it, the song only started to exist at the start of February. So, you know, it happens in the space of, you know, a month or so that it goes from song to getting the title track to evolving into this very specific pop art cover.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem very specific.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that there's no apostrophe in Sgt. Pepper.
I know, and, I know.
Am I allowed still to be annoyed about that?
You can still be annoyed about that. That's okay. But it also fulfills this thing that we talked about in the first part of the album sort of being by the Beatles, but sort of outside the Beatles. And in some ways that's signified by having the Waxwork Beatles on the cover.
That's a very modern thing. Do you not think that's a kind of like meta?
Yeah.
You know, there they are. They're standing beside the Beatles and the Waxworks, and it is this notion that I think they're leaving that mop top image behind, but also the idea that this is a completely separate band. So it's a completely separate fictional band, but actually once you start listening to the music, you realize it is a different band than the mop top.
Yeah. And it is interesting that even now there's, you know, we now have breakdowns of who the people are on the cover, but there's still unrecognizable faces. It's not an obvious collection of people, and each of the four Beatles gave a list to the artists in question about who they wanted to include and who they didn't want to include.
Yes, that's the thing. It's everyone seems to have had some input. I don't know that Ringo or, you know, George just came up with a list of Indian gurus, which again is this indication of where his head was at.
Yeah.
At the time, but one, you sort of think, well, these are. Contemporary, so you've got references to the Rolling Stones.
Yes. A band who are still touring. I mean, that is funny, isn't it?
Well, welcome to the Rolling Stones. You've got Bob Dylan.
Yes, still touring.
Still touring. The person who's not there, Elvis, isn't there.
Yes, yeah.
And that is an omission that I even sort of years ago when I was looking at this and you were saying, well, you're Dylan, you've got the Stones, and you think, well,
but actually there's none of the 50s rock and rollers there, really, is there? I mean, you've got Brando, which is, I know he's not a rock and roller, but he's certainly of that
but in
moment.
Terms of the idea being these are people that have influenced the Beatles or have sort of culturally influential, and you think, well, why did they put the Stones were ostensibly rivals? They could have not bothered name checking the Stones on the cover. Dylan was a contemporary and a rival. Maybe it would have been better not to put it, but why not? Why is Little Richard not there? Why Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, or Elvis? And just when I was researching this, I saw there was an interview from Paul McCartney, and he said, well, Elvis was too big.
Yes.
Elvis was,
would be a
like
distraction.
King Elvis.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was odd that the 50s influences aren't there.
And Stephen, you've got something to say about all the 87 people, so away you go.
Yes, number one, Aleister Crowley, a hugely prolific author of occult books. No, we better not
go down that avenue. There are websites that look into this kind of thing. There's also a website out there that has tried to source the original image for each of the faces that is used on the cover, which is a very noble task, I think, you know?
Yes. So I don't know. I mean, there are some sort of well-known stories about you, like Mae West is there, and she said she didn't want to be in a lonely. Why would she be in a Lonely Hearts Club?
Yes.
You've got Fred Astaire, who was apparently thrilled to be
on the cover.
On the cover. And the other, so all of these people who were still alive at the time, they had to get clearances from all of them.
Yeah.
And I think it's famously one of Epstein's last sort of messages was, please put this album in a brown paper bag. You know, don't do this, because it was sort of completely fraught.
Yes.
With legal issues about getting clearances and copyrights. And Epstein had, he was sort of notorious for falling out with his employees and sacking them and having massive rows. And
yeah.
He had just had that type of row and sacked his PA, and then called her back and tasked her with this getting all of these clearances. So.
It is fantastic. And I mean, you know, there's a bunch of urban myths or about the cover itself, that the white floral guitar on the front is part of the Paul is Dead myth. You know this one, that it says...
But you can see that.
It does say P-A-U-L question mark.
Yeah, it says P-A-U-L question mark. It's quite clear.
Yes.
Quite clear. I remember I pointed that out recently to my niece,
yes.
And she was stunned that you could actually say it.
But isn't there also a mirror thing where you put a mirror across Lonely Hearts and it says... I won, he die, or something.
This is
like
Paul has been dead for ages, honestly. Yeah. And then you've got the hand
above Paul's head
there. That could be, and on the back cover.
Yep, Paul's back is turned.
Paul's back is turned. Plus, you've got all the lyrics
for the first time on an album sleeve. There's lyrics on an album sleeve. A very simple idea, but a perfect idea.
Yeah. And also the very first reference, I think, to Apple.
Yes.
Appears on this. But it's this idea that this album is more lavishly packaged than anything that has gone before.
And it does, you know, it is lavishly packaged. It's in a gatefold. It has, you know, these little kind of cutout moustaches and everything else. It has the inner sleeve designed by the Fool, who seemed to be.
Did you cut out the moustaches?
I did not. No, I was already,
you're capable of drawing
protect
your own.
The record, even if it did. But it's interesting that, you know, apart from all these lyrics on the back, which is a bit of a first event, albums in those days didn't have credits, and you know, Peter Blake and Jan Hayward and Michael Cooper do get credits on the back, and you know, the Apple is mentioned, and George Martin gets a proper credit as well, so even albums at that point didn't get a credit. And there's also the little stone figure at George's feet appears on another album cover.
It's on Hey Jude.
It's on the Hey Jude compilation cover. That little stone statue sits outside,
and if you look at the spine,
it's flicked the wrong way around.
It's to be read by left handed people.
Yes.
You tip your head to the other side.
I think you'll find that this copy has done it wrong. I know. This is. I've brought in a copy today that we're just as if we've never seen the cover of Sgt. Pepper before.
Is this a bootleg copy where they deliberately?
That is my copy that came with the D'Agostini re-release from 2017. Those magazine.
And is it very rare because it has the spine
I don't
running the wrong
so.
Way?
No, I was thinking which copy of Sgt. Pepper did I not mind leaving the house?
Oh, I see.
So
right.
I brought that one instead of one of the precious ones. So I mean, it's a cover that's gone on to, you know, as I said, we're still looking at it over 50 years later, and it's a thing that's been copied and ridiculed and praised, and but it's still a very striking cover. And I think even for people who don't know the Beatles, it's an image that people would identify as, oh, that's a Beatles thing. Do you know what I mean?
It is. I mean, it is, I suppose... apart from the with the Beatles album is the sort of iconic early Beatles, this is the late period, and this is, everyone would know what this is and who this is. And as you say, the number of parodies, Frank Zappa, have you ever seen that album?
Yeah.
We're Only in It for the Money.
So
that, I think that, to my, as far as I'm aware, that was the first parody of the cover. So even at that stage, within a few months, it was being recognized that this is a sort of
significant
iconic thing that is. So Zappa rang McCartney.
Oh, right.
Or McCartney says he remembers getting a call to ask, would it be all right, or could, you know, just to say, this is what we're going to do. And could you, McCartney said he didn't really engage with them because he kept talking about product.
Right.
And he thought, this is about money. This is... You want something from me, and I'm not sure the Beatles ever actually signed off on it. But it's very funny if you get a chance. The album, that whole album is very good, but the cover is hilarious.
So the album, the last main recording session is on the 1st of April, and so the album is due to come out. Its official release date is still listed as the 1st of June in the UK and the 2nd of June in the US. It seems to have come out a week earlier in the UK, about May the 25th. But there's a bunch of work that needs to happen aside from the cover. to get the album finished. And so there's an awful lot of mixing and sequencing that goes on in April, some of it with the Beatles present, but a lot of it without the Beatles present, because for a chunk of April, for 10 days, Paul McCartney goes off to America. And he seems to sort of... he kind of goes over there, possibly planting some seeds, eulogizing this album that's coming out,
and
maybe also winding up people like Brian Wilson to say, "Yeah, you think you're in front?"
Yeah.
that kind of thing as well.
So we can blame Paul for Brian's
demise.
Well,
he's in America.
Decline.
He's in America from the Paul's in America from the 3rd of April to the 12th of April 67, and he goes to Los Angeles and San Francisco and Denver, and
Denver, a hotbed of
counterculture activity. I don't know, but
is
then
that with Jane Asher performing?
Jane Asher is performing at that time, so he's there with Jane. And then he flies back to Los Angeles and he meets up with Brian Wilson and John and Michelle Phillips, and he performs on the track Vegetables,
yep,
which we've mentioned before, where he's eating a carrot in a, you know, I think that's called foreshadowing,
yes,
for his later life. But as far as we know, he plays, or he has some copies of tracks with him that he's playing for people while he's over there, saying, you know, oh, just you wait, here it comes,
yep,
you know, we know. So he obviously knows that he's onto a good thing and he's doing his Paul PR routine while in America. He comes back on the 12th, and then there's a bit of work still to be done on the album. They do a little bit of recording on the reprise and Only a Northern Song and the Runout Groove on the 20th and 21st of April. But essentially the 21st of April is the last day when anything new is laid down, and you know, the Dog Tone and the Runout Groove are kind of added on at the end. And then it's just a question of getting the album off and getting the album pressed. But
yeah,
it's such a quick turnaround time when you think about it, that it's a month from the last thing being recorded to it being in the shops. Beatles at the end of April are still knocking around London. They go to see Donovan perform in concert. And he obviously gives them lots of tips as to what to do next.
And they don't go back in and apply his folk stylings to Sergeant Pepper.
To Sergeant Pepper, it's a pity, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what's interesting is they still keep recording. And there's a, you know, between, you know, finishing Pepper on April the 21st and Pepper coming out at the end of May, they record some of my favourite songs. They record Magical Mystery Tour.
Mm-hmm.
So that, even though they're nowhere near recording the film yet,
yep,
they have the song Magical Mystery Tour. And then some more of my favourites, Baby You're a Rich Man, All Together Now, You Know My Name, Look Up the Number. All those tracks get laid down in May. I think there's, oh yeah, and It's All Too Much also gets recorded in May.
I was waiting for you to say that. That's the best song.
It's All Too Much is a great song, and that could have been a great Pepper song if it had
that
just come in time.
Pepper
that
song
is certainly a high point of,
yep,
Beatles psychedelia. But May 67, yeah, to have all these songs, and they're kind of recording them without any purpose. The Magical Mystery Tour thing is still very embryonic.
Yes.
It's not something that they're going to do, but it's interesting that they've nothing else to do.
Yes, because I think it's right to say, or sort of fairly accurate, that up to this point in their career, they've been recording for specific,
yes,
albums or a single. You know, you have to come off the tour, we need a single, come into the studio, do a single, come, we've got an album release coming up, do an album.
Yep.
Here the album is in the can, but they just keep going.
Yeah.
And whether that's because they just have an abundance of songs lying around that they feel they need to get out and get recorded, or whether they are already sort of thinking, well, we need to stockpile,
yeah,
for something. But it is the first time I think that they're doing that. They're recording not for a specific.
And you're wondering what Epstein is doing at this moment, because you think, well, look, there's an album ramping up. Let's do a week or two of promo. Let's do some interviews. Let's get you plugged into certain things. But that doesn't happen. They keep on working. There's really only one thing that they do in order to launch the album, and that's they go to Epstein's house on, what's the date? The 19th of May to do a press launch for the album.
Because the background to this is that people think they're about to break up.
Yeah.
So all of this is happening against the media thinking, well, they haven't toured for a while. There hasn't been a single. Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane got to number two, didn't get to number one. You know, and there's that sort of those individual interviews of them arriving at Pepper, which they keep getting trotted out.
Yes.
Which is all sort of a bit of a setup where saying, you know, are you going to break up? Are you going to do solo things? Or any hint of, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, McCartney has this thing about, well, we knew that we were about to unleash something incredible. But clearly he knows that not only because he has an inherent faith in the album, but because he has been doing what you described, which is letting other people hear it.
Yes.
So
key influencers, we would say these days. Yeah.
Exactly. So he's let Brian Wilson hear. I think from memory, I should have looked this up, but I think it's She's Leaving Home is the track that he plays.
Okay.
To Brian Wilson. We mentioned earlier that, or in part one, that, you know, David Crosby was there and they let him hear A Day in the Life. And
but isn't there a thing where he says he's the first person to hear A Day in the Life?
Yes, yes. So he turns up at the lovely Rita
session,
and he describes them sitting him in a stool and wheeling in these enormous speakers like coffins on wheels, is how he describes it. He also says, you'll not be surprised to know, he's as high as a kite. So if you can imagine sitting in presumably this was Studio 2, they're state-of-the-art speakers. He's sitting in between these speakers, and they play A Day in the Life.
Yeah.
And he said by the end of that piano chord, quote-unquote, my brains were on the floor. So assuming that he can remember the next day what it is that he heard, he is, again, a key influencer.
Yeah.
That the word is out
that
amongst
this is happening.
Their peer group, this is what's happening. And plus, you also mentioned, you know, Mike Nesmith has been at the recording sessions, you know, Marianne Faithfull, Mick
Stones,
Jagger.
Yeah.
At one point or another, their friends and their peer group are dropping in and out of these sessions.
And just looking at the timeline here, Crosby's story checks out that A Day in the Life was finished on February the 22nd and Lovely Rita was recorded on February the 23rd.
So 24 hours later, they're playing him the rough mix.
Yeah, just you listen to this.
Yeah.
It is pretty amazing. There's also one of my favourite books on 1967 pop is The Act You've Known for All These Years by Clinton Halen.
Mm.
But it does have a very amusing opening line, which was, when Sgt. Pepper was released to a suspecting public, not an unsuspecting public, but a suspecting public. So I think at the same time, there might have been a bit of hype where people were like,
they were building up the anticipation.
We know this
it's
is
coming,
drop.
It's coming, yeah.
The other interesting thing that happens in May 1967 is on the 15th of May, Paul meets Linda for the first time at the Bag of Nails. And, you know, he meets her and says, oh, do you want to come along to a club? And she comes along and she hangs out and she ends up going back. And they're all hanging out in his house. And she said, famously, I was impressed to see his Magrits.
So, well, there you go.
There you go.
There you go.
That's a first date if ever there was one. But the reason why that's important is they meet on the 15th and this press launch happens in Epstein's house on the 19th, where a select group of DJs and journalists and photographers are invited into Brian's house. The four Beatles are there and there are some very famous photos, including my favourite photo of that day where Paul and John are kind of standing at either end of the Beatles and they're shaking hands and they're just laughing at each other. And that's a picture taken by Linda Eastman. And it's a picture that she instigated because she apparently was saying to them, you guys look too serious. Can we just have a bit of fun? And John and Paul have this flash of a moment. Linda gets the picture at the right angle. And so all these little, again, all these coincidences, all these gears are moving that she is there and they are there. And this is happening in Brian's. What's interesting is by the 19th of May, though, and something that I kind of only really realized recently, was that the album is on the airwaves. It is being played. And it starts getting played on the 12th of May that apparently the Beatles gave an 8-day window to Big L, Radio London, the pirate that was moored off the coast of Southend or somewhere, I don't know where it was, but a pirate radio station, because there was still no commercial radio in the UK. The BBC did not have a pop music station yet. That wouldn't happen until BBC Radio 1 launched in September. And so Big L, Radio London, along with Radio Caroline, are the two big transmitters of pop music and pop culture to the airwaves in the UK. And so Radio London gets this window of exclusivity. So people are hearing this album from the 12th of May, which is about 3 weeks before release.
People in London.
People. Well, it would travel a little bit on the medium wave.
Would it reach Liverpool?
I think some of those stations travelled up the country because if they were getting signals from Radio Luxembourg, I suppose they could get signals from the ship. But it's interesting because you know, somebody who's in the mix at this time is Kenny Everett. Mm. And Kenny Everett is, if you know who Kenny Everett is, you know who Kenny Everett is. If you don't know who Kenny Everett is, he's perhaps best known for being a television comedy star in the 70s and 80s. But back in the 60s, he was one of the first pirate radio DJs and was an influencer in youth culture and was very, very creative. And but he managed to get himself inside the Beatles
circle.
And he was one of the people who were at that Brian Epstein launch on the 19th, and as a very nervous, callow, youthful DJ, he got some words out of the Beatles, and he manages to preview the whole album on a BBC Light Programme radio show on the 20th of May with clips from interviews on the 19th, a show called Where It's At, where he plays previews of all the songs. So the songs are now getting into the national culture and discourse, but there's one song Kenny isn't allowed to play, which is
A Day in the Life.
A Day in the Life, because the BBC decided to ban it because they thought it was
just
druggy, which the Beatles have denied and said it isn't.
All those songs are quite.
Well, there's a very nice letter. You can read the entire letter that the BBC sent to EMI, which is like, we're terribly sorry. We know people are going to think we're awfully foolish, but we really have to ban this song. And, you know, we can't believe it's come
apologetic.
To this. It is very, very apologetic and very twee. But obviously, all publicity is good publicity. But that song does get banned by the BBC. And later in 67, when the pirates are shut down, I think Radio London, the last song they play is A Day in the Life, and the cord goes down and they shut down to make way for BBC Radio 1.
Did that band lasted for a long time, I think.
Which band? A Day in the Life.
Yeah.
Was it still there in the 80s?
I think it did. I think maybe it did run up until the mid 80s.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough.
Because A Day in the Life was released as a single.
Yeah.
In one of those sort of exploitation, re-release compilation things. And I remember it not being played then, sort of in the late 70s, early 80s.
That's interesting. Well, then, the album's official release date, people talk about it, the official release date being June the 1st. That's certainly the date that's used in the kind of record books or Wikipedia or wherever you look today. It seems to have come out into the shops a few days beforehand, but it becomes this soundtrack to the summer. And on the official day of release, June the 1st, the Beatles go into a studio and they do something that's very unlike what they do. They just jam for hours on end. And to be honest, I'm more curious to hear this than Carnival of Life.
Yes, because they're not a jam band. Not a band. You see the clips from Let It Be.
Yes.
And I mean, it's not good.
No.
It's not good.
And Lewison has heard this and says, it's not good, which doesn't mean I don't want to hear it. I'm kind of curious. There's about 3 to 4 hours of them just jamming, hitting organ chords, trying to figure out. And it's interesting, even though they've recorded all these extra songs since they finished Pepper, on the day it comes out, they're kind of doing this aimless, very atypical type music where they're just noodling. For what purpose?
For what purpose? Yeah. And I think it's Ian MacDonald in his book Revolution in the Head. He starts talking about this is the period where they as we would say over here, they start to lose the run of themselves. You know, they just begin to think, well, random things will happen and you have to embrace these random things or these accidents. And if you just, it's because we're doing it, it must be good.
Yes.
So whatever we do is worthy of, you know, getting on tape. And he talks about, you know, if you look at those songs that they're recording, they're sort of throwaway. I think it's You Know My Name, Look Up the Number, which I think is charming.
Yeah.
That this is just a waste of time and this is very self-indulgent.
Yes. And if you look at other albums that are released within 4 weeks of Sgt. Pepper, you have albums like Are You Experienced by the Jimi Hendrix Experience, The Supremes, Sing Rogers and Hart, Double Trouble by Elvis Presley, the soundtrack, Flowers by the Rolling Stones. Famously, on June 1st, David Bowie releases his debut album, David Bowie, which Sinks Without Trace, really, and Headquarters by the Monkees, which is a great album.
Great album.
But that's kind of the milieu into which that album is dropping. But you kind of look at later in the year and how the after effect is that, you know, you've Piper at the Gates of Dawn coming out in August, the first album from Pink Floyd, which you could argue is, you know, hugely influential in a totally different way. And then by the end of the year, you have very different takes on the music of 1967. You have John Wesley Harding from Bob Dylan coming out. You have Satanic Majesties from The Stones, which does seem like a response to Pepper in a way, you know, that kind of colourful cover. You have the Who Sell Out, Forever Changes, and you know, something else by the Kinks, and Capricorn, Pisces, Aquarius, and Jones by the Monkees as well. Another great Monkees album.
Monkees are very
three albums in 67.
Very prolific.
They weren't. Weren't lazy.
They weren't slacking. This is again back to my single unifying theory that Pepper is really the point at which everything coalesces in a single, you know, single album, a single event,
yep.
And then it starts to fracture and go off in different directions. So, you know, it's difficult if you listen to Piper at the Gates of Dawn. You think, well, there's not a Beatles influence there really that you can that you can detect.
Yes,
you've got the Monkees, which is the kind of perhaps the younger audience, although by late 67, but I suppose particularly. Whenever Head comes out then, yep. Subsequently the Monkees are heading in that direction, but at this stage in 67 they're still tapping into that younger fan base.
Yep.
So the Beatles are older, their fans are older, the 10, 11, 12 year olds aren't listening to the Beatles, they're going to be listening to the Monkees.
But the Beatles' curse is that all these things are happening because of the Beatles,
because
they've made pop culture recognizable, monetizable, you know, it's invigorated. If you want to be totally corporate about it, it's invigorated people to put their hands in their pockets and buy the stuff. So the spin-off is you get Pink Floyd, you get the Monkees, you get the Velvet Underground, you get all these things.
And it all seems to spin off after Sgt. Pepper.
Yes.
That's, you know, there's something here, there's the mums, there's the dads, there's the kids, there's everybody loves this album. It's kind of the hippies, the heads. And then after Sgt. Pepper, there's kind of all of these different strands. I mean, I suppose you've got Prague, you've got the Monkees, you've got the West Coast. And I say it's this transition from, this is almost like London signing off as the swinging centre of the universe.
Yes,
this is the last kind of sign off from London, and now it's over to the West Coast of America.
So then let's talk about this afterlife of Pepper and the notion of the album, because I've said before, I think the Beatles were an albums band from the very start, Please Please Me with the Beatles. But something happened with Pepper where, you know, there was kind of a critical consensus that says, oh, the album is the thing. The album is the statement for musicians now. And, you know, you could see commercially that albums started to outsell singles, that people started to define themselves by the albums they put out, not the songs they put out. And you kind of see it in, we were talking recently about Cream, you know, they were releasing singles, but they were kind of moving into albums territory at the same time. There's a big shift that's going on. And so whenever I look back at stuff that looks at, you know, the greatest albums of all time, you look at these lists when they start to appear in the 70s, and Pepper's always at the top of that list.
Yeah.
And it seems kind of sacrosanct that there is no other album that that counts. And it seems inherent on people being around in 1967 when it came out that that album gets that status.
I think that's right. I think it this notion that this was some sort of peak, this was some sort of pinnacle.
Yeah.
And that everything that comes after is sort of influenced by, or nothing can quite measure up to Pepper, but it's because of its universal appeal. Plus also you had that 6 month anticipation, more than 6 month anticipation.
Yeah.
What are they doing in there?
Yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah.
And everyone is waiting for, you know, it's almost like the tablets to be handed down from the mountain. And then when it comes, it's spectacular.
It is good.
In terms of everything, the packaging, the content, the leap forward in studio craft.
Yeah.
You know, you can argue the songwriting is, you know, they've written better songs. They go on to write better songs. But as a sort of a thing, a total sort of package, it's all there. And in terms of its reach.
Yeah. I think something that's important, that's sometimes forgotten about, is it's the first Beatles album that's pretty much released the exact same all over the world at the same time.
Yes.
So you have, you know, there's no difference between the US Pepper and the UK Pepper. So it is easy to get a consensus because the US got a different Rubber Soul, a different Revolver. Yep. So those albums didn't get a consensus the way that Pepper got. And it sort of lasts. I mean, I first listened to Pepper on, I remember the date, it was a bank holiday in Ireland. It was the 1st of June, 1987. And you can figure out why I listened to it on that day, because it was the height of hype about Pepper, that it was 20 years ago today. And this kind of Pepper hype seemed to last for those 20 years, that the people who were around in 67 kept voting it as the top album of all time. There was a Paul Gambaccini book I remember buying at the time that had the top 100 albums, and Pepper's at number one. And you know, I'm thinking, yeah, that is a great album.
It is. I mean, I think you're right, and that's why I think subsequently there was maybe a little bit of a backlash against that it became a kind of a generational thing. That sort of, the 60s, of course, everything was better in the 60s, and the best year was 67, and in 67 the best album was Sgt. Pepper, and there then becomes a reaction to that.
But it is interesting though, because you know, with all that, it was 20 years ago hype. There was a bunch of things happening. The Beatles were landing on CD in 1987. There was Derek Taylor wrote a book called It Was 20 Years Ago Today, which recounted Pepper and all the other pop cultural achievements of the year. And then there was a big 2-hour Granada TV, ITV documentary that tied in with that as well. And certainly to my mind at the time when I saw these things, it seemed like another world. 1967 to 1987 seemed very, very different. And you're being told by the television, oh, this is significant, I must pay attention.
Yes. I mean, 20 years was a long time then.
When you're not 20 years yourself.
Yes.
But there was a bit of 60s revivalism at the time. You know, I remember Channel 4 in the UK was showing Ready, Steady, Go.
Yeah.
You know, The Avengers and The Prisoner were getting kind of reclaimed as cult classics. It was referenced in adverts. Oldies radio meant 60s radio at the time. Mm-hmm. So you could tune into the 60s at the time. But yeah, once you kind of get out of that 20 years, it was 20 years ago today period, and maybe, you know, rock criticism is people who were born after Pepper came out, and different kind of music takes over, you know, Pepper kind of loses ground and people recalibrate on the Beatles overall and what the best Beatles album is overall. Do you think that's right? Were they like, because to my mind, the 90s, Revolver becomes the best album, and in the 21st century, Abbey Road becomes the best album, and the White Album always seems to be the second best album.
Yes. No, I think that is right. I think it reflects, you know, the sort of shift away. There's a lot of artifice about Sgt. Pepper.
Yes.
I mean, even from the made up nature of the band.
Yes.
On the front cover and the kind of studio trickery or overdubbery that's going on. So when you get a kind of a swing back towards, you know, guitars and
open big inverted commas, reality and authenticity.
Yes, authenticity. This sort of becomes unfashionable. So whether it's punk or whether it's the kind of guitar-based Britpop or whether it's Americana or sort of lo-fi stuff. This then becomes something else. It's symbolic of the 60s, but the 60s are no longer held in the same regard. So the point is, for me, kind of growing up in the 70s, which were pretty grim, and into the 80s, and then you kind of got the whole kind of Thatcherite thing going on, and greed is good. The 60s were seemed to be some kind of golden age to aspire to, but then, you know, the punk and in the 80s in particular, the 60s fell out of fashion. They were no longer, that was where things started to go wrong. So as you have a kind of cultural swing to the right, the 60s become the source of, it was drugs and the generation
loose
gap
morals.
And loose morals and kids not knowing when they were well off. And Ian MacDonald in his book deals with that. He's got a very good essay in that in Revolution Head that deals with that.
Yeah.
But I suppose the irony now is you look back on Ian MacDonald's book and you think, well, that's no longer the fashionable theory either.
Yes.
So it is this sort of cyclical thing, and I think Sgt. Pepper just kind of goes up and down around as those.
But yet it still gets mentioned as sort of a something that all artists have to do in their career. Oh, this is their Sgt. Pepper.
This is their Sgt. Pepper.
You know, that this is the moment where they experiment and they break out of themselves and what albums are like Costello's Imperial Bedroom or something like that. You know,
But again, you think of the production on that album.
Yeah.
that compared with something like his first album. Hmm. So it's you know, am I right in saying he had Jeff Emmerich?
He had Jeff Emmerich.
So it's any album that has a lot of studio trickery and overdubs and heaven forbid orchestras and string sections and things.
Is our first mention of Jeff Lynne in season two?
Well, I could, as soon as I started that sentence, I could
kind of see him.
Well, there is that aspect. There is that kind of 67 is where Jeff Lynne.
Yes.
As I said, he
sticks his boot in the ground.
He listens to Sgt. Pepper, Magical Mystery Tour, takes that as the template and never looks forward.
Yeah. Takes the piano from A Day in the Life and turns it into Mr. Blue Sky. And now his hand is on your shoulder, Stephen, and all that kind of stuff.
Quick, move on.
I think for me, as I said, I love Pepper. I'm very fond of it. I keep finding things to come back to it. The first big reassessment I had was in 2009 when the Mono Box came out, and I'd never heard Pepper in mono before. So let's talk about Pepper in mono for a bit, because the assumed wisdom is that mono Pepper is the best Pepper. And when the CD reissues came out in 2009 and I got the mono CD box, I thought it was like hearing Pepper for the first time. It is a different thing. It sounds great.
Yes. This is, I agree with you up to the point where you were saying it sounds like a different thing. Mm-hmm. It does sound completely different. I grew up listening to the sort of the stereo pressings from the mid-70s.
Yeah.
That's what I'm used to. I got the 87 CD, which was the same. When the mono version came along, it sounds rougher.
Yes.
The transitions between songs are a little bit clunky. Some of the editing is on display.
Yes.
In a way that I think it isn't in the stereo mix.
But the story goes the Beatles were there for the mono mix.
Yeah.
That was what they signed off on, and they weren't there for the stereo mix because stereo was seen as a fad or not the definitive article.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I mean, I absolutely accept that the mono version is the way it was meant to be heard, the way the Beatles wanted it to be heard. For me, and I suspect for my kind of generation, it's not what we are used to. And it is so ingrained that hearing the mono mix was incredibly jarring. And it seemed to me that some of the edits and some of the transitions are smoothed over in the stereo mix in a way that it almost sounds like it's a rough mix to me.
Well, I've made a note of some of the mono differences that I remember grabbed me at the time and still sort of stick out to me because the stereo is so familiar. There's like extra guitar notes and noodling at the end of the opening Sgt. Pepper track.
Yes, yes.
She's Leaving Home is in a totally different speed and pitch.
Yeah.
Benefit of Mr. Kite, the effects come in differently and they sound differently as well. Within You, Without You, the laughter is a lot louder at the end. It sometimes gets lost, I think, in the original stereo mix. 64, When I'm 64, sounds really tight and compact. It's not kind of, it's much broader on the stereo version. The drums and piano on Lovely Rita sound great. You get that really clear, I don't believe it, right at the end of Lovely Rita that gets lost in the stereo remix. The Pepper reprise, the edit is totally different. The noise from the end of Good Morning, Good Morning is much kind of blunter, as you kind of point out. But the drums sound amazing. And Paul has all these shout-outs at the end that are missing in the stereo version. Thank you very much now. Thanks for coming. Like all that stuff that he's still doing now in concert starts there. And sort of A Day in the Life comes in faster. I wouldn't say it's clunkier, but it just sort of lands in on top a lot faster than it does in the stereo version.
Yeah, I think, as I say, it's the fact that it's pulling things out.
Yeah.
Is what is slightly jarring for me. I enjoy listening to it, but it's very difficult for me to get past the notion that this is a kind of rougher mix.
Yes.
And that really the stereo version is...
But it is worth reminding ourselves that radio was in mono at the time, certainly in the UK, and that these are the versions that would have been hitting the airwaves, not the stereo versions. But then that brings us on to, 2017 and the kind of reassessment of Sgt. Pepper through the box set. And I certainly remember, it's not that long ago, obviously, but people were saying the Beatles will never do a super deluxe edition multi-disc box set. And here we are. But I think the Sgt. Pepper box, they got it almost right, apart from leaving off only a Northern song. I think they get the balance right between, they're never going to give us a Dylan style, here's every single second of studio recording ever.
No.
Maybe that's for the 100th anniversary.
Yeah.
But I, like, for the purposes of today, I went back and listened to the bonus discs again. I hadn't done that in a while, and they do tell a great story. And it is, you know, we talked earlier on in part one about the chronological recording, and you can hear those songs evolve chronologically on the box set as well. But I think it's a good box set overall. Were there any insights you got to any particular songs?
I love the box set, and I think we touched on this previously, which is some of those basic tracks.
Yeah.
That you think, you know, they'd stop touring. They were saying, the songs are too complicated. We can't play them live. I would love to have heard them kind of
rocking out to that.
Rocking out to
just
Sergeant,
like Hendrix when he played Sergeant Pepper the weekend it came out live.
Yeah, that you think if they'd kind of taken that into a small theatre and just done a live run through or done rehearsals in a theatre where they were recording and playing these things live.
And you hear it in songs like Good Morning, Good Morning. There's an Anthology 2 version and a Pepperbox version that just rocks. And it's a totally different song, a bit like the I'm the Walrus has a similar Anthology 2 version as well, which is just them rocking out.
And
as a
that's
band.
The kind of thing I would like to hear. I suppose we always want more, and we want the 60th anniversary box set, and that's the one I'd like to hear more of those kind of studio run through takes. You know,
but you kind of also notice their sense of arranging on these songs is really interesting. So something like the naked version of When I'm 64 on the box, without the horns or anything else, at the clarinets, it's really empty. It's just bass and drums and Ringo kind of playing to the song in a really retro, fantastic way. But then you get into something like Penny Lane, and one of my favourite things on the box set is the piano instrumental of Penny Lane.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing.
It is. And you think, how do they do that? I mean, it's a musician thing that you can hear, you're playing something, you're playing a basic rhythm track, but presumably in your mind, you're hearing.
Well, Paul seems to hear
line.
In records. He hears in arrangements where, you know, not many people do that. Some people hear in melody or rhythm or whatever, but he kind of seems to hear in records. So for something like Penny Lane, which is three pianos that he's playing overdubbed on top of each other, which eventually get buried into the mix. When you hear them on their own like that, you think, this is how he was putting the song together in his head.
He knows this. He's a very clear sense of where he's going.
Yeah.
You listen to things like Lennon doing his acoustic version of Strawberry Fields. There's no indication that he's kind of grasping his way or working his way towards that finished mix.
Yeah.
McCartney, you're absolutely right. He seems to start with a much clearer idea of where this is going to end up. But I'm not the only one to say it, but that piano version of Penny Lane, it sounds as if it could have dropped off Pet Sounds.
Yeah. Yes.
And that was the thing that struck me, was that's a little instrumental that Brian Wilson could just have slotted into Pet Sounds.
Yeah, it's so clean and ornate and well recorded. It's if you haven't heard it, it's really worth seeking out again. And the other thing the box made me realise, and I know we said this in part one, is just Ringo. Ringo's, that snare sound that Ringo has on Pepper is really brought to the fore on the Pepper box. And when it's stripped of overdubs on things like Good Morning, Good Morning and Getting Better and all the rest, Ringo's business. I know he's learning chess at the same time.
Well, this is the thing, but he's the one that is sort of saying, it didn't really enjoy the recording process, and you know, once I'd done my basic stuff, but yet he's so central to it. And I think part of the problem, one of the reasons why it was so underappreciated, is this idea of they were recording on four track, then they would create a sort of a reduction mix onto one track to give them another three tracks to be.
Yeah.
And it's always the first things that are being recorded are the bass and the drums.
Yeah.
So the drums are getting mixed, pushed further
down,
and further down.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I thought was startling was that they kept each of the sort of reduction mixes.
Yes.
So Giles Martin was able to go right back. So each time they did that sort of reduction mix onto one, they kept the four track.
So they could,
so they could kind of unpick it. So that's why Ringo was saying, I love these. This is great because you can hear the drums. And that's the most striking thing of the new remixes or the remasters are that the drums are sort of resurfacing.
So one of the engineers was interviewed recently about these Beatle remixes, and they were talking about how even when you're unpicking previous generations of tape to get the individual tracks, tape will always run with microscopic differences
in speed.
And what they ended up having to do for a number of tracks when they were trying to sync up, it's not a question of putting them into a computer and syncing them up. They would literally be riding the very speed control of a second tape machine as they were playing the old tape machine to try and layer it on top and get it as timed as possible. So there's some really manual work going on into these remixes. But yes, I think the Pepper remix, you know, because we had this mono stereo split before, it's the remix that needed to happen more so than any of the other subsequent remixes. And I some people don't like it, but I love it.
I do. I love it. Again, it's a separate thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're probably always going to go back to the mono mix. I'm probably going to go back to the original stereo. It's the one that's ingrained in my head. But
yes,
it's a completely different experience. And I absolutely love the Giles Martin.
And it's kind of in an era where we have these smart speakers and this odd kind of return to a new kind of mono. It's kind of designed for that kind of listening experience.
Yes. Yeah.
Any other particular songs you want to pull out? Any other anecdotes that we might have gone by? We kind of have barreled through an awful lot. It's a huge topic, Sgt. Pepper, and it's a big album. And as I said, there's been so much written and said about it, we could probably do a whole series on Pepper.
Well, good. I mean, I think that there is this thing. Each song has a sort of little background, just a little backstory. Whether it's we touched on, you know, Paul McCartney and the traffic warden for Lovely Rita, although he's very adamant, you know, that
didn't happen.
Well, he said, yeah, it happened in the sense that, you know, he got a parking ticket, but he said that wasn't that wasn't what he was thinking about. The one I suppose is Tara Brown and A Day in the Life. So we maybe talk about Tara Brown and that his connection with the Beatles at some point in the future. But basically, he's a socialite, one of the beautiful young people. In 1966, 67. He's very friendly with Paul McCartney, very friendly with Mike McCartney. He and Mike McCartney sort of holidayed in Paris together. And if you've ever read Mike McCartney's autobiography, it's a fairly slight thing, but it's a very interesting book. And he describes himself as the kind of working class Liverpool guy heading off to Paris with this, you know, very fabulously wealthy aristocrat who's sort of saying, "Don't worry, I'll pay for everything." And Mike says, "You know, about being a proud Northerner." I say, "Great," you know. And the idea was, you know, Lennon is sitting and he's got the Daily Mail up and he's reading about the accident or the inquest, and he's writing. Paul says, no, that's not what he thought that song was about. That he thought this was about, for some reason, about a politician.
Okay.
You know, he blew his mind out in a car that was a kind of a drug thing, or it was a thing. And he wasn't, at that point,
plugged
making that connection. He said, well, that may be what John was thinking about, but that's not what I was thinking about. And it's that idea that they can, these two people are collaborating on some amazing piece of work, and they're just coming at it from completely different angles. They don't really, aren't necessarily on the same page, but they're still creating this amazing kind of piece of art.
Third thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff that, going back to the box, made me, you know, think about this album again, you know, particularly the back end of the fourth disc. There's all these crazy mono mixes with awful phasing and string effects and all that kind of stuff. And there's a Penny Lane take that's taken off an acetate, which is a bit controversial as well. But one of the things I did notice was, like, for fixing a hole, it's probably the first instance we have of what I would call Paul McCartney's spitting image songwriting, you know, where he's just writing a song about what's happening around him. He's literally apparently fixing a hole one day and he's like, "Oh, I'm fixing a hole," and just off he goes. He's like, "Hey guys, I've written a song about fixing a hole." They really did think all things were possible and everything they did was
anything they did was worthwhile. But this is the thing, this is the point at which Lennon is sitting around reading newspapers and watching the TV. Paul is fixing holes. Well, again, he says, you know, that people say, "Oh, I was fixing the roof on the farm that I bought up in Scotland," but he said that didn't happen until, you know, I did fix the roof, but I didn't do that until 69 or 1970s. People are just but then the idea that, no, it's actually a drug song, it's about, you know, a fix, it's about heroin, it's about injecting, which is equally nonsensical. And this is, I suppose, is really the beginning of where people are trying to impose their own interpretations on what's going on, whereas really what's happening is they're just writing about what's happening around them.
Yeah, I think, look, it's an album that we could talk about for more episodes into the future. It's certainly worthwhile always going back to Sgt. Pepper and having a listen to it again, even for the purposes of our podcast this week. It's been fun to just go back and, you know, listen to it with fresh ears and try and pull out little new details and bits and pieces that we haven't heard before. And the 2017 box set is as good a place as any to start, particularly the book, which has a huge wealth of information. And I have an internal logic that says any box set you buy, that the ratio of listening time to book reading time should at least be 1-1, if not longer.
Yeah, I think in these box sets generally the books stand on their own. You know, they're worth reading on their own.
So I'm going to stick my flag in and say I think it's my favorite Beatles album.
Okay. but this is the
you also have a theory that the first album of an artist you hear is your favorite album by that artist.
Yes,
and this was the first non-compilation Beatles album I heard.
Well, then I have to give you that because that links in with my
theory.
I really like this album. It's not an album, I have to say, it's not an album that I go back to a lot, but that might be over familiarity.
Yes,
and when I do go back to it now, I've been going back to the 2017 mix.
Yeah, there's more there than we think, and if we can achieve anything through these podcasts, it's to make you just go back and pull records off the shelf and listen to them again and just marvel at how wonderful the Beatles were. So that's Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, an album by the Beatles, and it's been fun to talk about it. We are available online at all the same usual places, at Beatles Pod on Twitter, Facebook group run by Stephen, so go look for the Nothing's Real Facebook group and ask to join. And if you download us in your usual places and subscribe, we appreciate all nice reviews. We're all very welcome to listening to those at any time. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. We shall see you the next time.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.